That's the one that started down this morning, Jeffers, is on the island. And that's the port.
I had other ones, Jeff, and we can just doze this way unnoticed.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Tryons. I'm executive director of the Oregon Progress Board. I was asked today to come to review with you some of the benchmark trends that affect this committee. So let me just leap right into that.
Thank you.
Now, you've both seen the show before, so I don't know how you want to handle this. Do you want to just ask me? I mean, do you want me to start going through it so if members appear who haven't seen it, they can leap in? Or and the introductory materials, I certainly don't need to review with you.
I would suggest that you just start in, and it's possible that on reflection, members right. have questions, comments Good. On the material that they've already seen, and on reflection, you may have some additional things.
I'm happy to do that, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. As I was saying, you're all quite familiar with the benchmark, so I won't spend time introducing the topic. We'll just leap right into the ones that I think relate most to the work of this group, this committee. And they would be in six categories of benchmarks: economic development, competition and regulation, labor, infrastructure, energy, and issues related to telecommunications. So I know they're not all right on the button for you, but they all relate to the work that you do. So let me begin with the economic development. In this category, we've made a couple of significant changes, and I would want to note them prior to starting. We dropped three of the benchmarks in this area. We dropped the one that relates to business closings because all of our experts said if you have new companies and you know what's happening with jobs, you really don't need to measure the closings as well. So we dropped it. We got rid of middle income and replaced that with one that we called the income gap, which I will explain when I reach that. And then we dropped a measure that relates to international travel and substituted one that relates to Oregon's exports in terms of international. So let me just go through all the benchmarks that we have in this area. Please stop me at any time if you have any questions. You should have a hard copy of my slides in front of you. Starting with the benchmark that relates to employment across the strait, one of the things that we measure is how well rural Oregon is doing in terms of jobs in comparison with the valley. So we have a measure which looks at the percentage of jobs created outside the valley in comparison with the jobs created inside the valley. This number for many years was right about 74-26. That is, 74% of all the jobs in Oregon that we had, employment overall, was inside the valley. 26% was outside. In 1994, that number started to drop a bit and went from just under 26% to just under 25% between 1994 and 1998. Now, 1% may not seem like a lot, but when it goes from 26% to 25% in rural Oregon, it's something that's actually felt. We had some positive news in 1999, which is that number came up a bit. So we saw the ratio of jobs in Oregon, somewhat surprisingly, as a matter of fact, increase a little bit more towards what the historic average had been. One of the things that's one of our lead indicators of kind of the new economy, if you will, is the way the professional services sector in Oregon is increasing. That's one of those job sectors that we believe is really important for us in the information economy, if you will. So what we measure is the proportion of professional service jobs in Oregon as they compare to the national average. So if we're moving up towards the national average, that means that more and more we're increasing the professional services sector in Oregon. If we're moving the other way, it means that we're moving more and more under the U.S. average. You can see here that starting in the early 1990s, we were about 80% of the U.S. average. We moved up a bit to about 84% in the mid 90s, and now we've dropped off a bit. The reason for that is that we've seen a much slower increase. In fact, we've seen a reduction in services in jobs in Oregon in the banking sector, whereas the U.S. has increased pretty significantly. That's the one sector of all the professional services where we've seen a really significant fall off.
So the Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So the in that previous one, the Oregon's Constantarian is a basically a contrarian that is trying to be a banker. Is that the deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, yes, Constantarian is actually a specialized progress board word that
the
we
getting in trouble with my Republican colleagues. It sounds like something right out of W's mouth. Procedure. Excuse me.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I won't comment on the Senator's last remark.
That's probably
That is clearly a typo, Senator, and thank you for pointing it out.
Just kidding.
You'll notice on the right-hand side there that the targets that we had set for 2000, which all are developed with expert input, was that we would be up closer to 100% than we are now. So we've lagged in that area quite a bit. In terms of new companies, which is another one of the indicators that we pay a lot of attention to, you can see that in terms of Oregon was one of the best states in the nation for new companies. That is, per capita, we were really highly ranked. Number one here would be the best. And in 1998, we went from being seventh to 14th. So we slowed down as the economy slowed down here. This is an indication of the Asian flu as much as anything. So we have seen a slowing in the creation of new companies. On the other hand, in terms of our strength in the traded sector, does everybody know what traded sector is? That's the, I see some head shaking and some not, so let me explain it just a bit. That's a measure for us of how well we're functioning in the outside Oregon economy. So if the primary product of an industry is either traded in other states or is in the rest of the world, that would be in here. Fred Meyer wouldn't be as included here because their trade is mainly within the state of Oregon. So we've actually improved a bit in terms of our traded sector standing in the years between 1994 and 1998. Another good measure of Oregon's economy over time is economic diversification. We're about an average state when it comes to diversification, and one of the things that's happened is that in spite of the fact that we've had a substantial increase in the high-tech economy, it's been pretty concentrated as well in a few sectors, so it didn't help us that much with overall economic diversification. So we're right in the mid to high 20s, which isn't surprising, and that's pretty steady. Research and development is one of the keys for us in the long term. Oregon can't succeed in the new economy without having some research and development activity occurring here. That is, we can't just be a high-tech manufacturing state. We have to be a state with R&D, and as I'm sure you all know, Intel does quite a lot of its R&D here in Oregon now. We were quite low in terms of our overall research and development spending as a percentage of the gross state product in the early 90s, and we've come up from about 0.5% of GSP to 1%. The U.S. average is 2%. Washington State is 3%. So, and they're one of the highest states. So none of the numbers get very high, but we're still only at 1/2 of what the U.S. average is. which is where we want it to be. In terms of...
Senator Becker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on that point. What is the hopes or the outlook with the OGI-OHSU merger? And it should lead to more research and development and opportunity if we make the right investments this session in engineering and some targeted investments. I would think the hope is that the research and development percentage would go up, or at least the prospects for it would go up, which would really lead to better diversification of the economy.
Madam Chair, Senator Deckard, this is actually industry research and development that we measure now, but the next, when we redo the benchmarks, which we will be issuing in a few weeks, we'll have one for industry and one, we'll have one for academia. So we'll be actually focusing on that academic generated R&D, and of course, as you know, the synergy between the two is one of the things that's been lacking in Oregon. And the strong states have very strong links between industry and higher ed, and that is the intent of much of the work we're doing in higher ed, and that should help us.
Mm-hmm. Just one other point on that.
Certainly.
University of California, San Diego, I just read a report of the investments that they made in that university and the spinoff, the private sector spinoffs from, they brought their School of Engineering there into the top 25, 35, mm-hmm. 40. And the private sector spinoffs have been incredible in the corporate revenue that they're generating and the jobs that they're generating just from that small state investment. It was startling to me in terms of the progress they made on these two mm-hmm. past charts.
Mm-hmm. I would agree, Senator, that it is often a very powerful investment, and that's much of what Oregon Shines is really oriented towards, which is increasing the knowledge base and the ability for Oregon to be a leader in some of these areas that really makes for more stable economies, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of I've skipped venture capital, excuse me. Another one of our new economy indicators, if you will, is the amount of venture capital investment in Oregon. Any of you who have followed this will know that Oregon has been up and down in the numbers, but mainly because of how much venture capital there was out there, not because there's so much less in Oregon, but in the mid to late 1990s, the U.S. economy was awash in venture capital, and so that's why there's so much variability, really. It's not because Oregon's amount of venture capital has varied that much, and in fact, in the last few years, Oregon has done very well in terms of the amount of venture capital that it has been able to attract.
Mr. Tryon's, our committee staff has a question for you.
On this measure of venture capital, is that in mm-hmm. absolute dollars, or is that dollars per capita?
That is dollars per capita. We wouldn't show up on absolute dollars. Net job growth, this is the overall economy, not a surprise here. Job growth has slowed in Oregon as the economy has slowed down a bit. Oregon is a very export-intensive state, so when the Asian flu hit the U.S. economy, it hit Oregon especially hard, so you would expect to see job growth per capita falling. Net job growth falling in 1998-1999. When I first, Madam Chair,
let me ask a question about the targets.
Yes, ma'am.
If you could just expand on what are the assumptions behind the targets?
The progress board is unusual in this aspect of the way we do this tracking. Most states don't set a target. They'll just sort of have a thumbs up or something to show trends. But the statute actually requires the progress board to set targets for benchmarks, the original statute. So what we do is we the progress board polls experts. We have hearings on this. Any citizen can come in and say, you know, what their opinion is. Now, it would be hard to get an informed citizen opinion on what the target should be for net job growth, because that's not the kind of thing that you get very helpful input in from non-experts. So we go to the labor economist, we go to the Economic and Community Development Department, we'll look at information that's out there, and the board sets the standard as ambitious but realistic. That is, when they set a target, they want it to be one that is realistically achievable, and that's across the board for all the targets, but it's ambitious. So in 1996, when they revisited targets last, and you can see we were above the target at that point, what the state economist said and the state labor economist, et cetera, was, you know, we're probably going to fall some, so let's lower that number a bit. We fell more than we expected, but that was the thought and the intent. When I first started this job, I had an opportunity to spend some time with Neil Goldschmidt, who was the creator of Oregon Shines, and he said to me, when I started Oregon Shines, it was for one reason, and it was to get Oregon's per capita income level back up to the national average. So this indicator of how we fare on per capita income, that's all income, that's wages, transfer payments, investments, et cetera, is still one of the board's key indicators. And you can see that Oregon did very well in the early 1990s after languishing at about 10% less than the national average all through the 80s. Oregon actually was increasing quite nicely through the early 1990s, flattened out in 96, and then fell in 98, 99, once again primarily as a result of the economic problems with Asia. But that's not to say we're not doing well, it's just that we're doing less well than the rest of the country. So we fell a bit in 1998, 1999. This is a new measure we have, which is one of the things that's happening in Oregon, which is a troublesome thing, is that income disparity between the highest income households and the lowest income households is increasing at a rapid rate. So Oregon has always been an economically centered state. We didn't have a whole bunch of people who were really, really rich, but we also didn't have a whole bunch of people who were really, really poor. It was more a middle state. Well, lately we've been seeing this trend of the gap between high-income households and low-income households expanding. In fact, according to the people who published this report, Oregon's income gap has expanded more rapidly in the 90s than any other state. So we've gone from being from the richest households having six times as much income as the poorest, that is the fifth highest set in the top 20% and the lowest 20%, let me say it that way, to being 11 times more wealthy. So that's almost the wealth gap is almost twice what it was in the early 1990s.
Senator
Deckard,
why is this occurring?
Madam Chair, Senator Deckard, I can't give you all the reasons. One of my theories is that both our in-migrant stream as well as the jobs that we've been creating look like that. That is, we have more and more, we had at least during a lot of this period, more and more well-educated in-migrants who were coming here to take the good jobs at Intel. And we had more McDonald's jobs, more low-wage jobs. So we just weren't creating as many middle-income jobs. So we saw household income, which is primarily wages for most households. The other thing is, I would estimate that the stock market has a lot to do with this as well. If you look at 1998, that was a very good year for stock markets. So people had a lot of money in stock, had a lot of capital gains, and so that's part of income. So that would knock those folks up, whereas the people in the lower quintiles wouldn't have stock investments, wouldn't have capital gains. So it doesn't mean that wages have worsened on average, but it means that we're just seeing a split in terms of the bifurcation. You know, the average is sometimes misleading because you can have a spread this wide and you can have a spread like this, and the average can be the same. So so we're trying to look at the spread as well as the middle. Is that a satisfactory answer, Senator?
Yeah, thank you.
I would like to hear your comments on these targets again and mm-hmm. the assumptions behind mm-hmm. the targets.
These are, Madam Chair, this is a new benchmark, so the board just set these targets. And as you can see, there's a hope, and this is really simply a hope. There's nothing, we don't have many handles on how to affect the income gap. But the hope is that we as a state can recognize that the gap is increasing, and it is at an unacceptably fast rate, and that we'll start to bring it back down some again. So these are simply hopeful targets is the best I could characterize them, Madam Chair.
Let me inquire a little further. What does Sessions, how is the Progress Board looking at the hope piece in terms of policies that we might craft in this legislature that would impact how and whether we get to the targets?
Madam Chair, the Progress Board just adopted this benchmark because it was raised as an issue which they ought to look at. So we've done very little analysis on it at this point, Madam Chair. I couldn't even come back to you and suggest a set of policies. For most of the key benchmarks we've worked out some things that ought to happen. You can certainly put it on the board's agenda as something that they ought to get staff to look into more, but we don't have anything right now, I'd have to say, in all honesty.
I would encourage the discussion. I'm just saying the obvious. The trend is a very unhealthy trend for our state. And Senator Hatcher, did you have a comment?
No, that's my hot button. Maybe we'll talk about it when we get done.
All right.
How do you translate this into action?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
I've been frustrated for 6 years now, so I don't think I'm getting answers.
All right. Please continue.
I can still complain.
So that's the economic development waterfront, if you will. So let me move on to the issues relating to competition and regulation. We've also made some significant changes here. We've got a new measure that we went out and found. We didn't feel like the measures that we had, which related to business taxes, workers' compensation, and health costs to business, were really very adequate to look at all of the issues which relate to Oregon's competitiveness as far as industry is concerned. So we went out and looked at all the indices that were out there. We did a whole assessment of this. And the one that we finally landed on was a three-part measure, which I'll explain in a minute, which allows us to look at labor costs, which allows us to look at issues related to taxes, and which allows us to look at issues related to energy, which they have as their three primary, or as the three parts of their index. So in terms of permits issued on time, this is obviously a hot button for some industries. How responsive is state government to their needs to be regulated in a timely manner? The two that we've chosen and the Progress Board has had over the years were air permitting and wastewater. And you can see for air, we were pretty much at the target level, which was about 65% of all of the permits would be issued on time by the year 2000. For water, where we were simply shooting for 40% of the permits being issued on time, we haven't hit that target for just about any year during the decade. So that's an issue, and I might say that this is one that where action could occur. I mean, we have the facts, we have the agencies, we know who are the regulators, and we could find out what the problem is. We've had it for a long time. People think it's a pretty good surrogate, at least on the environment side, for how responsive we are to kind of regulatory needs. This new labor index, index that relates to the cost of doing business in Oregon is three parts. The first is labor costs. You'll look here and you'll see that labor costs have dropped significantly between 1995 and 1999 vis-a-vis the rest of the country. As I understand it, the reason for this is because of the productivity of the high technology sector. Our high technology workers are much more productive per unit of output than many of the workers in the long-term economic ventures we've been involved in. So that's not, labor costs haven't dropped because we're paying our workers less. Labor costs have dropped because our productivity numbers have increased vis-a-vis the rest of the country. In terms of taxes, this is a combination of a whole mix of both personal and corporate taxes that they use, the outfit that we use to calculate these numbers. But their ranking has had Oregon as the 40th highest in terms of tax costs in the early 1990s. Mid-90s, we dropped to around 26th, and now we've kind of inched back up to about 32nd or 33rd. I don't know which it is from looking at this. Energy costs has been Oregon's big competitive advantage. You all know that quite well at this point in time. We were the number three or number two state all through the 1990s in terms of the cost of operation when it came to energy. Those numbers will change some in the next years, as we're aware. Now, this only makes up 10% of the index, so it's not a huge factor, but it is something that is going to hurt us in terms of our ranking over time. So the overall rank shows Oregon, mainly because of that reduction in labor costs, moving from about 25th in the nation in 1990 to about 12th now. So according to national statistics and a national organization, Oregon is the 12th best place in the country to do business right now. It's pretty good. Labor statistics. Looking at annual payroll, Oregon workers on average got their first pay increase in the mid to late 1990s in about 15 years. When you do inflation adjusted analysis, you see that Oregon wages were pretty flat all through the 80s and early 1990s, but have increased, as you can see from this chart, pretty significantly from 1995 to 1999. Now, this is one of those average wage things. Most of those wage increases have occurred in metropolitan areas, and they've primarily occurred in the Portland metropolitan area. If you looked at rural Oregon, you wouldn't see this kind of a chart at all. And we actually split that out. I just didn't include that slide. The percentage of Oregon workers earning 150% more of poverty, which is another one of those measures of economic well-being, this is interesting because it actually goes the other way a bit. We've gone from 30% of all Oregon workers earning 150% more to 35%. So we've seen an improvement in that in spite of the income gap. And the request that you made, Senator, we'd be well served by looking at all of these and trying to make sense of how they all work together. Why would we have a larger percentage of workers making 150% more or more of poverty when we're seeing this significant increase in the gap between the lowest earning household, the lowest income households, and the highest income households?
Let me stop you there and take you back to the previous slide, because I'm trying to understand context again.
Right.
You said that one of the slides that you did not include captured what this payroll on average increase looks like in rural communities.
Yes, we can stratify this, and we have it in the benchmark report between urban and rural.
Okay, I'm trying to relate the piece that we don't have, which is the rural piece, to the higher percentage of workers doing better. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And I think that we would primarily see that the reason for the percentage increase has to do with urban workers and not rural workers.
And how is the increase in the minimum wage factored in?
I've wondered about that, but you see these numbers starting to go up a bit prior to the increase in the minimum wage. So I would have to say that it has helped to contribute with moving the whole wage scale up a bit, but minimum wage workers still wouldn't make it into the 30 to 35%. So this isn't a family wage, and these are only workers who are in the unemployment pool. That's what covered workers are. So there are a lot of workers who aren't in here at all. This is a surrogate kind of that says, from the ones we know about, here's what's happening with them. We changed the way we measure unemployment. We used to measure the absolute unemployment rate, but it doesn't help us very much if we don't know how we're doing vis-a-vis the rest of the country. So now we measure unemployment in relation to the U.S. unemployment rate. So how much higher are we? And we're always higher. We're not always higher, but we're almost always higher. How much higher are we than the U.S. rate? You can see that we were actually under the unemployment rate for a while during the mid-1990s, during the hottest part of the economy, and we've been slowly increasing as a percentage of the U.S. rate since 1995. So we're at about 130% of the U.S. rate for 1999. In terms of Oregon workers receiving 20 hours of skill training or more, that is one of the workforce education measures that we feel is important. We find there that we haven't really increased worker training at all since we started measuring it in 1994. Oregon has had the benefit of having, as I said earlier, a well-educated workforce moving into our state as part of the in-migrant stream. We are a state with a lot of in-migrants, and we found that during the early 1990s that the education level of in-migrants was pulling up Oregon's overall education level from about 23% of Oregonian adults had a college degree to 29%. That was 40% of all our in-migrants at that point had a college degree, almost one in two. We've seen that flatten out now. It's flattened out because the California economy had improved during that period, and because Oregon wasn't so much less expensive as a place to live that it was a major draw for folks who could come here, earn a pretty good wage, and live very cheaply. That advantage has pretty much vanished for us over the 90s. One of the other things we measure, which is key to the high technology economy, is folks who have associate's degrees. That is, people who have training, some specialized training, specialized knowledge, and we find that only about 4% of the population where the office, the Department of Community College and Workforce Services, I think I said that right, would like to see us being able to move up to about 6%. That's what the goal was for last year. We didn't achieve that. High school dropout is one of the issues that we continue to struggle with in Oregon. We're not unlike. Welcome, Senator Yee.
Well, I don't know.
I have an open chair.
I think she must have heard that you weren't asking me enough questions. And was as you know, Oregon has a significantly high rate of high school dropout. About 22% of our kids, on average, ninth graders, don't finish school on time. Now, a lot of them go back to community college, they get GEDs, they get some certificate, but we lose a lot of kids. And more, you probably saw the big article in the Oregonian where they tracked all these classes from various high schools in the city of Portland, and they were losing 30% and 40% of their kids, and really they were leaving school. It wasn't like they're, you know, we're not managing to catch the transfers, et cetera. We've got a lot of kids who aren't finishing school on time. That's both a long-term economy problem for us as well as a social problem, because the kids who leave school are often the ones who end up with the teen pregnancies and in trouble with the law, et cetera, et cetera.
Senator Harper.
Why did we elect not to count GEDs?
Madam Chair, Senator Harper, we didn't used to count them. That's why we have the dots around those. So now we count GEDs.
I get you. It seems to me that we should count them as not dropping out.
We do now, Senator Harper. It
we're counted as dropouts.
In other words, for those years where we have the dashed lines, I'm sorry, this obviously is not as clear as it might be, but the dashed lines mean that GEDs weren't counted in those years. By statute, the Department of Ed, it was required in 1997 to start to count GEDs as not dropping out.
That's what that bullet means.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So in 1997, they were incorporated in and counted as high school graduates.
Okay. I just misread.
Yeah. The information. So those are old numbers that we tried to make it clear that we were, that the data source wasn't the same, and obviously we didn't make it as clear as we could have.
Okay. Senator Corcoran.
Madam Chair, Senator Liebeyer pointed out in a revenue committee this morning that another part of the statistic that will fool you is that even though that would appear to be an alarmingly high dropout rate, if you then look a couple of years ahead, you'll find that a lot of those, even though you count GEDs now, don't you have a cutoff point from beginning of high school or something?
Yes.
Senator Meyer was saying that if you just extended that a little bit, what happens is we find that these kids do, either through community colleges or whatever, they'll get their GEDs and they'll get on with getting on. You know, it doesn't give any indication. I still agree with Jeff that you still are probably talking about a high risk population in terms of these other issues, and they're probably going to, you know, they could probably, as a category of kids under 22 or under 25 or whatever, you would probably see a higher correlation in low income, low wage, low skilled jobs. But it's one of those statistics that is alarming, but then you consider the other ramifications and it's a little more tolerable.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, we actually tried to figure out how it could be that we had this high a dropout rate and still by age 25 we have a fairly well educated adult population, and it mainly has to do with the office of with community colleges are in the GED business.
That's exactly right. High schools with ASTRAs, they call them.
Yep. And thousands and thousands of people a year get their GEDs. Quite frankly, economically, a GED is not as good as a high school degree. It just does not count as much, and it has all these other social service ramifications as well.
But Madam Chair, I do have to say too, though, that those kids that do pursue that GED, the GED doesn't count for much, but at least it completes one level of training and it gets them can potentially get them into another level of training. Where not having the GED, they're
Madam Chair, that's exactly right, Senator.
Probably a large margin, better
We measure literacy in Oregon infrequently, but we know it's one of our most important long-term workforce measures. In 1990, Oregon was a lead state in a national literacy survey that was done, and we found that at that point that about 40% of Oregonians achieved an intermediate literacy level. That means that they could read fairly complex stuff. I mean, it's the kind of things that, you know, that we would all do fine on, have no problem with. It's not the highest level. There's an even higher level where your interpretive abilities are really challenged. I've actually looked at the questions. But this is people who can function adequately within the world would be able to achieve an intermediate literacy level. This is a house-to-house random survey. So it is very hard and very expensive. So we only do it every 10 years. The feds will be fielding their next one in 2002. You will see a request from the governor to appropriate $100,000 as a down payment on the O2 literacy survey. We'd very much like to be part of the national survey again, because without us supplementing it, we get very little information about Oregon and literacy in Oregon.
I believe our committee staff has a question for you.
Would you help me understand what the bullets prose, document, and quantitative mean on there?
Well, there are three kinds of literacy that are measured as part of the literacy survey. So prose literacy is just can you read and understand a paragraph? The document literacy is, can you read a bus schedule? Do you know, can you understand the various kinds of forms and things that you run into in life? And then quantitative is are you able to figure out how much your kid needs to get if the doctor says, one tablespoon of medicine every 3 hours. It's not that you have to be able to do math, but you have to at least understand quantitative concepts.
That's the test for how you get on Ways and Means.
Senator Harper.
Let's see. Thank you, Madam Chair. But 40 or 50%, we're proud of 40 or 50%. We're happy with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Harper, it's not bad within the nation. We did the crosswalk for the national survey. We didn't ask exactly the same thing, so we couldn't get exact numbers, but this puts Oregon in, up there in the top 15 states or so.
Hmm. Wow.
I would just add a little sidebar. We had, my colleagues will recall, we had visitors here from Zambia yesterday. And Zambia, the African nation, has a higher literacy rate than what we're looking at here, which is remarkable.
Madam
yes.
Chair,
Senator
I too regret that we consider this a relatively high literacy rate, or it's no longer within the nation, but a world economy mm-hmm. that we're talking about, and when we're ranking 20th in the world and math and science and literacy alone below Zambia, we're the least literate this nation has been in this nation's history today, and that's not good for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, people don't read as much as they used to, Senator, and that's just an absolute key to literacy.
It's teaching children to read at the first grade that's key to literacy. And when 40% of them are not taught, we cannot expect any other outcome later.
Thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair?
Go fix that.
I just want to take a real quick look at the infrastructure, energy, and to telecommunications related measures we have. We don't have many, quite frankly. We look at the percentage of Oregonians who are served by drinking water systems that meet federal standards, essentially. That the huge leap there was when Portland came into compliance with a copper and lead regulation, I think. We show that about 90% of our water systems should be or are at meeting all the federal standards. The goal is 95% by the year 2010. Sewage was an issue that we measured for a long time until we found out that we were only measuring a project in Southeast Portland and a project in Eugene. We don't have any good statistics on sewage statewide. So we've had to move this off the benchmark list, and we put it on something we call the developmental list. We still feel that the board still feels like it's an important thing for us to know, but we, quite frankly, don't know enough about the status of sewage disposal statewide to report on it. So that's been moved off the list. And we don't have any other energy measures other than the one that's in the index, which we looked at earlier, except for CO2 emissions. And the only reason that's an energy measure is because most of the CO2 emissions within the state come from some form of using energy. And here we see that Oregon, by 1997, had increased its CO2 output by about 10% more than they were in 1993-94. It's essentially a measure of economic activity at this point in time. In terms of internet access, we've seen, not surprisingly, a dramatic increase until over 60% of Oregonians have access to the internet now, and we see, I thought I had another slide there. We know that about 70% of all Oregon households have a computer in their homes. So another way of looking at that would be that 90% of all Oregonians who have a computer in their home have access and use the internet. But that number is increasing. As you can see, it's gone up amazingly since 1998. So we're beginning to reach the point where having a computer in your house is very much like having a phone in your house in, say, 1960 or 1955. So there will be internet access of one kind or another for most Oregon households within the next 5 to 10 years. I would imagine once the whole state is wired for the internet.
Senator Becker.
Actually, Madam Chair, Jeff, you just kind of hit the point I was going to make, but I think, to me, out of all of the slides in this, I think this one might be the most important, is ensuring, and in my area, you largely have almost near-universal internet connection.
Right.
But I think the greatest challenge for this state is to ensure, and the smart states will do it, that all their citizens in all their areas and across the state, and rural and across the state, have, and the children at the youngest age are interacting with technology, because as the economy continues to move to an information-based economy, I think some areas it's just naturally going to take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think my district would be one, but I think that's the most important thing that we might do, is ensure that first and second graders across Oregon have access to technology and are using it in every school and classroom and house.
Madam Chair, Senator Decker, as you know, we're investing a lot of money in that right now. I would agree with you. We will be issuing grades, as we do every 2 years, and everybody in state agencies gets awfully uncomfortable when we issue these grades, because, and rightfully so, they often don't control these things, but yet they're being held somewhat responsible for what's happening in the areas. If we look at economy overall, we will see a slight worsening in these measures over what we had in 1998. It's just that the economy has slowed down since 1998, and when we set the targets in 96, we were sort of looking at a continued improvement with the economy, and that's just not going to happen. So let me just wrap up with three very quick slides that are results of the survey that we did, the population survey. We asked Oregonians, how do you think Oregon is, not Oregon state government, Oregon is doing at providing a series of services. You can see that the top-ranked service, and it's true every time, is community colleges. 91% of all Oregonians think that Oregon does a pretty good job with that. Parks, Oregonians love their parks. That's number two. Four-year colleges and universities has moved up to third, which is a change. They didn't used to be up that high. And then when you get down to the fifth one there, you'll see that all government, when we ask them about all government, 78% of Oregonians had a positive response about the public sector in Oregon. Creating jobs, which is an area that you're responsible for overseeing in terms of legislation, is also right there at about 78%. The lowest one, not surprising, is Oregon's ability to fight drugs. Crime fighting, on the other hand, has increased pretty dramatically. You can see, if we look at the change between 94 and 2000, that that the biggest improvement was Oregon's ability to fight crime. The second biggest was Oregon's ability to create jobs. 1994, most Oregonians didn't believe the recession was over yet. And between 94 and now, most Oregonians are pretty convinced that that last recession was over. Now they're worried about the next one. And if we look at the short-term improvement in public perception of public involvement, you'll see that the biggest gainer between 98 and last year was four-year colleges and universities. The biggest loser was healthcare. We saw a dramatic drop in that. And the job piece was the fourth largest in terms of gains. That's my presentation. I'm going to be a little late for cabinet, but I enjoyed the opportunity to be here, and I'm happy to take any other questions, comments you might have. I know Senator Harper might have one before I leave, and I'd be happy to hear it.
Well, I just want to keep reinforcing, just for the record, I'm frustrated by the disconnect between a superior program and legislation. Yeah, I think every bill, policy bill, and budget bill should be tied somehow to making these things better, and and we don't seem to make that connection. It's just frustrating. And I just appreciate you carrying the message every time you get a chance to talk. You know, plea, you can't do it, the board can't do it, but just make the plea. You guys try and think about these when you're writing a bill. Figure out how you make that connection. I think we have a better state.
Madam Chair, Senator Harper, if I might comment, I made a presentation yesterday to the Senate government, to the House Government Efficiency Committee, and a new member called me up and was so excited to know about this that she wants me to come meet with her. She wants me to meet with the freshman because she thinks that this is something that they could really run with and get involved with. And I can tell you, and I'm doing this right now with Ways and Means, when Ways and Means asked me to go ask agencies about why their linkages to Ways and Means, or why their linkages with the benchmarks aren't stronger, they pay attention. If the legislature pays attention to this and asks agencies every time they're up, well, what's the link to the benchmarks here? How is this helping us with the goals we have? I can promise you that it'll get more activity and attention than it does now. But we're working away, and I have to say we've made some progress. I know, Senator, that it's frustrating for you, and it is for me too. But we are. We're moving ahead, I think.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, Madam Chair, the benchmarking process is certainly makes Oregon a star among other states. When you go to any of these national conferences on state legislatures, clearly we're a model for the other states. They want to know. I mean, other states, even as recently as last year in Chicago, one of the discussions in one of the conference meetings was how you create benchmark processes, you know, and I mean, we've been doing it long enough that we're actually getting some very good results. Mm-hmm. And in terms of tying it into legislation, I mean, I think that some of these are just kind of situational quandaries. I mean, certainly we could take one aspect of these, education, all the way from K through 12 through higher education, you know, through the research and development component that you are interested in, Senator Deckard, and Senator Starr's interest in the ability of first graders to read. I mean, I think those are, that is one policy area where we could directly link benchmarks and, what we're doing legislatively. I think it becomes very problematic, frankly, to try to do it in terms of some of the other categories of, wage disparity. Some of those things are market driven. Mm-hmm. Some of them are geographically driven. You know, some of them are driven by Bonneville. There's all kinds of reasons why we have those situations. But those things that we can control, the one that really sticks out is what we do in the education area. We could probably do it in healthcare to some degree too, because we have such an advanced process in terms of the health plan. But it really is difficult to try to pin these things from a public policy standpoint in some of these areas. I mean, I watched the labor stuff. stuff, and I watched the Progress Board for years before I was involved in the legislature. I mean, it was a great idea at the time, and, you know, you kind of look at it the first time, was it Oregon Shines or whatever? Mm-hmm. First time you see that document, you kind of go, man, here's a bunch of bureaucrats creating jobs for themselves, you know? And then you look at what the results have been over 10 years, and it's like, you know, we're a model for the other states. So I think for the education side of it, it wouldn't be that difficult to, you know, to have some sort of commitment by legislative leadership to say, you know, we will in fact, you know, I mean, the discussion this time is you have to have 16 votes and a letter from the governor saying he won't veto. It might be nice to have something that says that you can't do education legislation unless it's tied into benchmarks, you know?
Madam Chair, just a brief response, if I might. Senator, I would agree with you that there are some things where the benchmarks are simply the wallpaper. They are what's happening around us that provides the context within which we all work. And I think the fact that Oregon has taken the trouble to say, here's a relatively small number of measures that we're going to pay attention to over and over and over again, is actually quite a useful tool for you in and of itself. This doesn't happen in most other states. There's no place where all that stuff is in one place where you can look. But the other thing is that there are areas, especially in the social services area, where we've really focused in on you know, one benchmark or another, whether it's teen pregnancy, whether it's adequate prenatal care, where it does encourage and spur activity and changes have occurred. But part of it is leadership here. It is the legislature saying we're going to use this stuff and we're going to pay attention to it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tryons. And I guess my closing comment would be, as I look at the slide on page 21 at the top, the perception of the quality of different public services with the emphasis on public services, the thing that's most striking to me is in looking at the category families in need and health care. What I have in the back of my mind is that Oregon leads in hunger. And so that's a reality that I have to overlay on top of this perception that there are all these Oregonians who think Oregon is doing a good job in these various other categories. But there's this other reality out
there. Madam Chair, I'm up to my ears in that hunger analysis. I was just at the Hunger Task Force today, and we're trying to make sense out of the fact that Oregon's numbers and the federal numbers don't actually match up, and we really want to know what the hunger situation is in Oregon and who is hungry. So,
thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
For your time and for the effort that you put into this additional presentation before the committee. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
And Chair, I hope the Sizemore folks don't find out how happy people are with public services either.
We know that you won't be the one to tell them.
My lips are sealed.
Staff, what are we doing next? We have a bill up.
We have Senate Bill 193 for a public hearing.
Okay. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 193.
Madam Chairman, this is a bill for the concept and the results asked for are relatively simple, but they're in the context that is mind-numbing. In short, there are circumstances in which a person who wants to receive unemployment insurance, by the way the benefit is calculated, may find it to their advantage to withdraw their application for benefits and apply at a time period where the calculation will give them a higher benefit. The way the law is written now, they can't do that. This change lets them do that.
Are there any questions for staff before we continue with testimony?
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I just want to point out that we already do something more progressive with this calculation than most other states, don't we, Mr. Putnam?
I don't know the answer to that, sir.
Okay. For some reason, I had it in my mind that we do, part of our calculation is more beneficial to a worker applying using the last quarters than other states.
That's past my knowledge.
We'll have to ask. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I believe we have one person scheduled to testify. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I'd like to invite Sharon Hill forward. And in doing that, also acknowledge that Sharon Hill is a legislative assistant on my staff. Very proud to say that. And Ms. Hill has been working with a constituent whose issues bring the piece of legislation that we have before us. And with that said, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for that introduction, and I'll just skip to the last part of the testimony. Just for the record, my name is Sharon Hill, and I am Legislative Assistant to Senator Gordley. I'm testifying on behalf of a constituent of ours, Cheryl Dunne. And what I, in response, Madam Chair, in response to Senator Corcoran's question, I appreciate the support of the staff, but we are both willing to defer to Frank Ritchie from the Employment Department about anything specific about the unemployment calculation. We're just real willing to pass that on. So he's in back of me in case we need to get to that detail. I believe I wanted to thank the Employment Department. This has been a real collaborative process, dealing first with a constituent concern and then also working with the Employment Department on the language for this bill. And so Verlina Crosley, the director, John Walton, Don Brockhouse, and now Frank Ritchie, covering my back, it's been a collaborative process, and I wanted to acknowledge that. In addition, I think Ms. Crosley's letter that you have in front of you explains the situation. What I want to just clarify is that current law right now allows you to cancel an unemployment benefits claim based upon three different conditions. No benefits have been paid, you haven't been denied or disqualified, and you haven't requested an appeal. That not requesting an appeal is what caused the problem, and that's what 193 attempts to resolve. So that third condition in Ms. Dunne's case, she had a question about what the determination of benefits was. We all naturally do when we get our letters and there's an appeal process, you request an appeal. But once you do that, you can no longer cancel your claim, which is that technical piece that we're deferring to the Employment Department about, which allows you to use a different quarter and that sort of thing. So she was then precluded from doing that. And the law is just real explicit that if you request the appeal, you don't have that right. So Senate Bill 193 just makes the distinction. We didn't want to create an onerous process or change things with the Employment Department. So their suggestion and what we've proposed here is just to distinguish between the redetermination piece and denials and disqualifications. So that's all we're proposing. And it's not retroactive. Ms. Dunne understands that.
Questions for Ms. Hill. Senator Corcoran?
So just so I'm getting this straight, thank you, Madam Chair. The person could question the level of benefits and not be disqualified. But if they appealed the disqualification or the denial, then they couldn't...
They couldn't cancel their claim. That stays the same.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's the change, is you could actually request clarification on your the amount of your unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And before you couldn't?
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, if you knew to not ask for your appeal, you could cancel your claim. And what my concern is, from a general public, put my general public hat on, most of us would automatically appeal, which then meant you couldn't cancel your claim and argue that benefit. And they would say, you can't argue that benefit. And so all she wanted to do was cancel her claim so she could reapply at using a different quarter or whatever it was. But because she exercised her right to appeal, she could not cancel it, so she could never get back to step one and start over, which is my kind of base way of trying to understand the canceling claim process as a non-employment department person. And so she was stuck in there with, we differentiated disqualifications and denials as a different level of reason for requesting an appeal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
I'm just trying to really get I totally support what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to get my hands around adding the words of a disqualification or a denial. So a person could still appeal their level of benefits,
Yeah.
Okay.
I interrupted you. I apologize.
So I guess that's what I was getting at, is that even if they appealed their level of benefit now without having the language just specifically of a disqualification or denial, then they would have been out of luck. They would have had to take...
Correct. That's the current situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Additional information?
Not for mine. Yes, sir.
Mr. Ritchie, did you wish to testify? Is there any illuminating information?
Did you have a good day today?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Frank Ritchie. I'm manager of unemployment insurance programs and analysis in the employment department. I think everything was explained extremely well, particularly with the clarifications. So I don't have anything to clarify or change.
Does the department support the bill?
The department isn't taking any position at all.
All right. We appreciate having that information on the record. Thank you both. Committee, I don't think that we're intending to take any action on the bill. This is just a public hearing.
We'd have a heck of a time. Although I think the outcome would be good if it was just part of the committee that was doing this stuff. Where the heck did the Republicans go?
Well, the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. If there's business, we are adjourned.
Pull a few bells off them.
Yeah.
And Chairman, there was also going to be a presentation on Senate Bill 30, well, whatever. The process of referring uncollectible debt to private agencies. Mm-hmm. That's on today, and I have a crew here who can give a long or short version of that.
All right. Please come up and give us a version that would be thorough enough for us to understand the issue.
Okay.
And make a decision.
And for the minutes, you really did not adjourn the committee. Is that correct?
That's correct. I did not.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Radford. Good afternoon. I'm administrator of the State Controller's Division in the Department of Administrative Services, and we've been asked to come talk a little bit about which was known last session as House Bill 3509, which resulted in some statutory changes, trying to get a handle on the improvement process of accounts receivable and debt collections management in the state. To my immediate right is Mr. John Dufresne. He's our statewide accounts receivable coordinator, and he's got some information here that is being currently handed out to you. We're going to try to go over very quickly kind of an overview of accounts receivable and debt collections information in the state, and then address a little bit about what we've been doing in the interim here since the legislation was passed last session, and how we think we're making a difference in terms of accounts receivable management.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is John Dufresne. I'm the statewide accounts receivable management coordinator.
Would you tell your last name, please?
S-D-U-F-R-E-N-E.
Thank you.
Kind of just to add one little step before House Bill 3509, because it kind of plays into the story we're about to tell. There was an audit done by the Secretary of State's office back in 1997, which identified opportunities to improve delinquent debt collections by state agencies. This is audit 97-77, and is one of the things we look to as we are trying to develop our methodology and working through this process. We wanted to take a larger picture, and as we show you those documents there, we took a step back after House Bill 3509 and said, let's go and look at the whole picture. What are all the receivables? And we talk in that first frame there about the statutory collectibles, the state annual financial report, and then we overlay that portion, which will become the liquidated and delinquent accounts, which replace the legislative fiscal office report that you probably received in your handouts before. The statutory collectibles are those collection activities that are performed by the state but probably relate to federal government monies. A couple of for instances would be like Perkins Loan Program that's done through universities where they're collecting federal monies through that student loan program. Another type of statutory collectibles you would find out there would be the child support payments. Again, they're third-party collections. Those payments will actually go to somebody else, although at some occasions a portion of that would be retained for the state. But as you can see, they're really not accounted for in the comprehensive annual financial report, which this is the year 2000, or fiscal year 2000 report. When we talk about the state annual financial report, that are actual monies that are within this document are state funds. When we look at the total receivables, again, we show the $5 billion there in total receivables. That's segregated into two pieces, the 2.7, which is the long-term receivables. Those would be mortgage loans, contracts, and such. Those would be the housing, veterans loans, so on and so forth. Largely, they're mortgages. They're protected by assets, and both agencies assured me that they're also protected by loan insurance. So pretty safe investment, if you will. The other $2.6 million is the shorter-term receivables, and on the next page, we talk about how they're broken down into three basic components. The $1.5 billion is the total accounts receivable. The $670 million is the taxes, which should be largely income taxes for collected by department revenue, which they claim about a 95% collection rate, and taxes, employment taxes collected by the employment department, which I believe the last figure I saw was around a 92 or 93% first-time collection rate. So largely, those two make up something in the neighborhood of 90% of that, around 95% of that amount, and again, have high collectability rates. The last little component of that is interfund transfers. That's agencies paying each other for whatever they need, Department of Justice, facilities for Department Administrative Services, so on and so forth. So we took the $1.5 billion and broke it down in each of its component functions, and of course we have the accumulator. We'd be here for several days. The smallest piece of that pie there is the $17 million is general fund money. Most of the accounts receivable monies are collected for the benefit of some type of a program and are not general fund money. For instance, on the right-hand side, what we label dedicated funds, those are like highway funds, wildlife, natural resource funds, grants and programs. Some of the lottery funds would fall into that segment. The next piece is identified as user-funded. Those are largely public works, what's known as enterprise funds, state hospital, OLCC, those entities that are operating quasi-business type operations. The next piece there at $508 million is called trust funds, and those would be like the state pension funds, deferred compensation, the common school fund, educational endowment, those types of, again, funds that are being monitored for the benefit of others. And finally, the last component up there, $439 million, is the other components, which Oregon Health Sciences University, the State Accident Insurance Fund, and those two are considered kind of quasi-agencies, and the last one would be the university program. So those all make up what are the accounts receivable. We talk a little bit about how those accounts receivables fit into the budget, and I'll just kind of skip over that piece. The next components is we try and frame, if you will, Oregon's accounts receivable with regard to four other large private companies, Intel, Microsoft, Gannett, and Nike. As you see, at 16.8% receivables as a ratio to revenue, we fall right in the middle. The following, we do the same thing with the six western states. Again, Oregon falls right in the middle, not, you know, average, if you will. The next graphic we shows how receivables have performed against our net revenues over time, over the last 5 years. And as you can see, the receivables remain fairly flat while revenues in general rose. One of the key features of the law for the state of Oregon is 293-240, which says that even though you may write off these debts, the debts do not go away. They go away for financial purposes, but if 3 years down the road you're a person that you've written off wins the lottery and you've got that name, you can still take that debt and apply it and collect those funds. The next couple of things we talk about, what would be the benefits of accelerating debt collections and what might be some of the negatives of that.
Okay. So that, back to the charge-off and reporting, mm-hmm. that gets to that notion that in a bankruptcy, for instance, taxes can still, even if a person declares bankruptcy, comes out the other end and starts creating wealth for themselves again, they can't child support, bankruptcy, I think there's one other category, they can't evade through the bankruptcy process.
Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran, bankruptcy is if you will, one of the exceptions where certain debts can be removed.
Right.
In other words, the way that the Attorney General's office describes it is the debts aren't charged off, they just didn't exist. But there are certain entities that do pass through bankruptcy, and I don't have that information with me, which one would go through bankruptcy.
I thought it was child support and tax liability was one of them. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't have that information.
But that's not what you're getting at here.
That would bankruptcy would be the exception. Anything else that was charged off, written off, would be always collectible.
Okay.
Again, I'd like to go...
Go to that last page there, yeah.
To the accomplishments page, it'd be page 9. Some of the things that was suggested, again, if you look on the left, there's a little graphic that's a page. Those were suggested in the Secretary of State audit reports as things that we should do. And the group were able to get the DMV records access for state agencies. There's a number of methods and ways that they can get that access through telephone, web, so on and so forth. There was created a statewide collection committee, which is now called the Accounts Receivable Core Committee. They meet twice a month discussing best practices. Right now, of course, some of the legislative bills are creating the topics, but looking at ways that they can improve their process, looking at new technology, and we kind of talk about some of those things. For instance, the Auto Dialer System Comprehensive Report, again, another thing that was recommended by the Secretary of State's office, comprehensive study, it's available on our website. You can go out and look at that. That referred to a number of other states, what they were doing in other programs, and find out what the cost-benefit analysis is, and that's available to all the state agencies. We developed a statewide master collection contract. The contract was went through the RFP process. We had 8 successful bidders. Again, we created a website that explains who is involved in that process. We linked them to each of their own private companies. We gave bios for each of the companies, and we have email contacts and phone lists on there, you know, a click and you can be in contact with any one of these 8. Another feature of the statewide collection contract was that we made it also available to 300, or what is now 300 local governments who have signed up, who are also involved in this program. If you recall the ad, I believe it was in the Oregon here last week, where there was $750,000 in Bend that they're trying to do some collections. We got in contact with them, and now they're looking at using that statewide collection contract as part of their process. We went through training on accounts assignment procedures. Again, we developed policies and procedures. We provide classes to say this is how you need to use the contract. The contract has a little bit of a flavor of a cafeteria plan, so there was some explanation necessary to say, you know, what are the needs of your agency and how can you make those needs known to the providers. We've been in a partnership with the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Reporting Committee, Legislative Fiscal, and our Accounts Receivable Corp people went together to help design the system. Legislative Fiscal put together a web-based program. We collected this information online, and it was a very impressive system. I think that Legislative Fiscal IT did a very nice job in that. We promoted the use of the 8 private collection firms. We held vendor fairs. We provided other types of information. Again, everything's on the website. You can point and click and go through and find out what their charges are, so on and so forth. Again, one of the other key features here is our web-based technology. We're trying to do a lot of information on the web. That doesn't mean just state agencies can use it. The private collection firms can look and see what the information is out there. Anyone can go out and look. We've had comments back from a number of local governments that, gee, we really like this collection contract. Why doesn't everybody do this? What we think we need to keep doing and what we are still doing is trying to do some education. We're working right now on what we're calling a strategic plan. We're identifying 5 areas based on the information in this legislative fiscal report where we're going to highlight and, of course, make that available to the legislature. But we're concentrating on an informational resource to the state agencies to help them see where they need to place their resources. One thing I would comment on in this report, excuse me, on page 6 of the report where it says on legislative fiscal report, the beginning balances to private collection firms was $50 million over that initial period, which would be just January 1, 2000 to 6/30, $44 million was placed with private collection firms. I understand that the flow of accounts is still moving, so we are seeing the accounts go through the pipeline, which we felt was one of the main purposes of House Bill 3509, was to get those accounts through the Department of Revenue and through into the private collection firms and get those kind of cleaned up.
That's where Mr. Marquis got his new suit, huh? See, okay.
We have more work to do on the accounts receivable, on the Oregon accounting manuals. We want to make sure that the policies are out there to explain what you do in a case of bankruptcy, to explain what kind of letters should be going out in collection letters, to explain what is proper due process and notification. I'll just kind of tag on a couple other things. I mentioned the strategic plan. Again, we're continuing to expose agencies to new technologies. We get calls periodically. We have some new software. We think it works really well. We put on little programs for that. We had the one of the three large credit bureaus come and explain how to look at a credit report, how to obtain a credit report, how that information might be useful, so that we expose the agencies to other ways that they can improve their debt collection. Some of the things we have listed in our future activities, again, is a vendor offset study. Some other state agencies have found that if they take their debts and apply them to payments that are going outside from all the agencies, they sometimes find that they're paying people who owe us money. And so it's an offset program, and it's a way to capture that money. And, of course, there's a lot of perhaps even legislation that may be necessary to do that, but that's one of the studies we'll be looking at in the future. We want to broaden state agency data sharing. There's statutes, sometimes there's just history that doesn't allow that data to be shared, and sometimes that's important in improving your collections. A couple of the last pieces here, we're looking for some consistent statewide receivable management information and management reporting. We want to try as best we can. Of course, each agency's task is a little bit different, and you get into the flavor of trying to compare a Microsoft with a General Mills, but we believe that there is some comparability there, and we're going to try and get that information to be comparable. And then we're going to continue to monitor accounts receivable activities of other states. Those were the key features. Do you have any questions?
I do. I'd like to go back to page 7. Just one question, clarification. In that second box, businesses threatening to leave the state or close, can you give us some context for that statement?
Madam Chair, these responses were accumulated based on showing of the PowerPoint slideshow to the Accounts Receivable Core Committee. And as we showed them this information, we asked them questions about, well, what would happen if we do these certain types of things? And that was one of the responses that we got from several people. From my own personal experience, I worked in the Department of Revenue for almost 15 years. I can tell you I heard that threat often, that we were taxing them out of existence. We can just go across the state in Washington. Property taxes are cheaper there, income taxes, so on and so forth. So that was one of the common things that I know I heard as well as at the Department of Revenue, and I don't recall which agency spoke out of this nature, but that was one of the common themes we heard there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions or comments? Question? Please.
In this business of sending the money out to, not the money, but the accounts receivable out to private collection agencies, have you felt that state agencies have been responsive to using that approach?
Madam Chair, Community Administrator Putnam, we've had, if you will, all levels of responses. Some are more hesitant than others. Others quickly respond. Others we've had to have further discussions with and try and show them the importance of this. It's a really mixed bag. Some agencies went through their receivables, I mean, item by item, and spent a lot of time going through and just trying to do a cleanup and making sure they understood that. Others knew their receivables backwards and forwards. They were giving me, you know, cost analysis. So you have kind of a whole mixed bag. one of the problems in the area is that you have some of the larger agencies whose actual part of their function is the collection operation. I mean, everyone recognizes that part of the Department of Revenue's function is to do collections. But when you start getting down into the boards and commissions that issue licenses and so on and so forth, their feeling is more that they're putting out a license and their collections, and maybe they don't even have a full-time collection person. They may not even have somebody that has any collection experience there, you know, make phone calls and so on and so forth. So, again, because the spectrum is so broad, as I like to say, from the Department of Revenue to the Tattoo Commission, you know, there's all kinds of things in between. Some were right on it. For instance, again, the semi-independent state agencies, as you'll notice on the one page, several of those are indicated as exempt. And it was just the way the law kind of...
We don't have that in front of us, but...
I can distribute that to the committee, Madam Chairman, if you'd like.
Madam Chair, we...
I have a copy in my office, but okay. We just don't have it in front of us at some point.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I would just like to ask Senator Deckard if he has any expertise in collecting from the Tattoo Commission, maybe give them a hand with these Generation X kids, all that, go through that.
Well, Madam Chair, I did not know we had a Tattoo Commission. We have a commission on tattoos?
It's actually part of an overall health sciences board, but... anyway, the semi-independent state agencies, several of them actually... participated even though statutorily they weren't required to. So again, they saw the benefits, especially the collection contract, how certainly they're not going to get the rates of 12% to 25% that's offered in the contract, so they certainly saw that is a benefit and immediately joined in.
Plus, we're trying to make a joke around revenue guys, and they don't have any sense of humor. No. Like
additional question.
Of the $44 million that's been placed with private collection firms, has that been going on long enough to get a feel for how they're doing? Are they collecting half of it, three-quarters of it?
Madam Chairman, Administrator Putnam, the law technically went into effect on January 1st, 2000, and this report cutoff was 6/30/2000. So presumably... this is the activity over 6 months.
There's a guy in a new suit that might want to be able to answer that
and
question.
He might even have a question answer there.
You want to call him up? He'd have to
please,
expertise in that.
Please join us.
About the only thing he does is answer.
I'm going to have that remark stricken from the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of Oregon Collection
Association. Would you get the mic in front of you?
Sorry.
So your son can hear you.
Thank you, Senator Corker. I just wanted to say the DAS has been great to work with under this new law, and both these Johns here have been great, and so is Mike Greenfield and Bill Brawley. Overall, I just from a collection standpoint, if you look at numbers on a national basis, monies flowing that get assigned to collection agencies and what percentage generally gets collected, you have to remember that when debts reach a collection agency standpoint or are assigned to a collection agency, they're debts that other people have given up on or been unsuccessful with for, and so they're older and they're tougher to collect. But the overall average is about 25% nationally, and that's taking, you know, JCPenney's and Ward's and all the other retailers and various people that their banks that assign stuff to collection agencies. We think that the initial debts being assigned to collection agencies today from the state of Oregon probably are less collectible than average. And I say that because what we're doing here is cleaning up a lot of stuff that has been sitting in a desk drawer for, I mean, I'm talking to a collection agency owner in Eugene who is doing work for the Department of Revenue under this contract, and he's currently working on tax year 1989. So this is not stuff that it would be the norm, and so we don't expect great success on the initial. But you know, you have to understand that part of this process is that DAS is, I think, creating an atmosphere in which receivables are going to be managed better at the front end, and that's what we would all hope for as taxpayers in Oregon. And eventually, if we're all doing a good job managing those receivables in state agencies across the board, my client isn't going to have much business out of this.
Thank you very much. For the questions or comments?
Madam Chair, do you know the difference between an introverted and an extroverted accounts receivable manager?
You're going to tell us.
An extroverted accounts receivable manager stares at your shoes instead of his. You want to strike that from the record, too?
I'm going to strike that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for providing the update on House Bill 3509 implementation. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with no further business, the committee is adjourned.